Well, welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I've purposely set up camp. You might be able to hear the outside. I've done that deliberately. How are you doing? I'm giving you double episodes this week because I am practicing what I preach and I am prioritizing my self-care. So there will not be another episode next week whilst I take a break, and I'm also teaching some of you incredible human beings on how to be effective in your allyship in a week-long Courageous Courage course. And then after that, I'm taking a break. So I'm giving you a double dose. After the previous episode, if you haven't listened to it, this is a call to action. A call to arms for you if you are white or hold white privilege. Go back and listen to episode 11. If you are black and brown, I recommend that you skip that one because it will probably trigger trauma in you. On the date of recording this podcast, it is Friday. What date? I'm losing track of days in the middle of this pandemic and global atrocities. It is Friday the 29th of May, and this has been an unprecedented week in terms of racism, overt racism, and murders and police brutality being documented against the lives of more than one black man. And the collective grief and the anger is palpable, and I have never felt fury quite like it. And as a result, my Instagram has exponentially increased in followers, and therefore the demand on me has grown. And one of the things I talk about so passionately, and I lay as a firm foundation for people doing anti-racism work, you cannot be effective in how you serve, on how or how you ally, or how you show up in the world if your cup is not full. So one of the reasons I'm having a wee break is so I can fill my cup and so I can serve from a more powerful place. But this is the reality of this stuff. It triggers trauma in us. It's visceral. It's in our connective tissue, it's in our DNA. Will Smith shared a Instagram post. I saw it last night. And he said, racism is not getting worse. It's just being filmed now. Like, this stuff isn't new to us. So, for those of you who are just waking up, again, the work is urgent. But what I wanted to gift to you before I take a short mental health break is a beautiful episode I recorded with Tamu Thomas, and we recorded this week, Wednesday, so Wednesday the 27th of May. And I had not slept the night before, and I was feeling very heavy from what had been going on. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna cancel this. And something within me said, don't cancel it. Tamu's work is all around everyday joy. And if you know me, you know I am somebody who absolutely will advocate and express that in this work, in this space, in our own healing, in dealing, in building resilience, practicing joy is so important to your well-being and building resilience and also coping with adversity. We often feel like if somebody else is in pain or there is suffering in the world, that we can't practice joy. And we do that in a way where we think that that's empathy, but it's not. It's vital for self-preservation. And I've used the analogy before, I'll use it again. For me, the reminder of the duality of feeling deep grief or sadness and practicing joy is when we are at a loved one's funeral, where the two coexist. You can have one corner of the room where people are cathartically sobbing, and another corner of the room where people are sharing beautiful memories and are just heartwarmed by remembering them and celebrating their life, and they're smiling and they're laughing and they're dancing. The two can coexist, and it's vital in this heaviness, especially if you are black and brown. It is vital. So I wanted to actually the timing of the recording of the episode with Tammy was perfect. We're talking about all of the stuff. We're talking about healing. We talk about practicing joy in adversity. We talk about ancestry. We talk about connecting with each other and connecting with nature. We talk about some of the race hierarchies that go on within ethnic minority groups. And we talk a lot about joy. So that's my gift to you, especially if you are a black woman. I've had a number of you reach out in pure despair to me this week. This is my gift to you from Tamu and I. After our conversation, we both felt so nourished after the heaviness, and I hope that this episode nourishes you too. A huge thank you to my patrons for signing up and supporting. I appreciate you. Enjoy the episode, and I'll be back after I've replenished my cup. And I hope you do too. Take care of you. Oh, got another wonderful human being with me today. The incredible Tamu Thomas, joy seeker, incredible human being, and a holistic life and somatic coach. Tamu, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for your invitation to be in conversation with you,
You're
Marie-Louise.
gonna get used to Tamu's poetic tones. And she's the queen of joy, and I can't think of anything more necessary and more needed in these current climates. So it's a pleasure to have you here. Let's kick off straight away, Tamu. Who are you beyond your roles?
Beyond my roles, I am a human being that is finally beginning to appreciate the adventure that is the journey of life. Previously, I would have said that I scan the world looking for joyful moments, but what I have come to realize is that I radiate the joyful moments into the world and they reflect themselves back to me when I am being still, whole, kind, observant, and devotional to myself and the experience of life. I am a mother. I have a child, a beautiful 13-year-old that is every day emerging to be a beautiful young woman. But beyond being a mother to a child, I am a mother. I've just this COVID-19 period of gestation, incubation, whatever you would like to call it, has revealed to me that actually I am a mother, full stop. And my mothering is compassionate and kind, it is caring, it can take care of your big feelings and hold space for you to explore them. And it will also give you an energetic, spiritual, and practical kick up the backside when you need to be more compassionate with yourself. I love humor. I can find humor in almost anything. And as a social worker, I had to be very,
Oh,
very
yes.
careful not to allow the humor to seep in inappropriately when giving evidence at the High Court, which would definitely happen. And more than anything else, I'm a lifelong learner. I really enjoy learning, and I think that life presents me with opportunities to like to learn at any given moment. And my latest thing, Nova, which I probably have shared with you, is that I've just discovered that I'm a romantic. And as far as I'm concerned, life is romance, and if it is not romantic, I don't want it. And by that, I don't mean easy, because romance we know has its challenges and its stretchy moments, but those challenges and stretchy moments are worth it because they are enveloped within the greater good. So
Yeah,
that's who
welcome.
I am.
Welcome, everybody. Tamu has landed.
Where's my gavel?
Oh my God, there's so much. Oh my gosh, there's so many things I want to ask you. Let's find out a little bit more about what it was like growing up for you. Where did you grow up, and what was that like being a black girl?
I started life in Ladbroke Grove. I
Ooh,
grew up
West.
in West London, West Side. I lived in Ladbroke Grove, I think maybe until I was nine. I can't quite remember. And that experience was beautiful. I knew that we didn't have much financially, materially, but the community was very strong. That was when the carnival was really the Notting Hill Carnival. Yeah. Both of my parents were activists and community organizers. So I remember our house often having Black and Asian people. At that time, there was a lot of stuff around being politically Black, and there were lots of politically Black Asian people, and there were all sorts of conversations about apartheid in South Africa, around discrimination, stop and search, inequity in terms of housing. So there were always those sorts of things going on. My dad was a musician, so there was always music in our house. He was always going to the studio, or our house would become a home studio. Those were the days when you were regularly visited, not just by your aunties and uncles that weren't really your aunties and uncles. We lived on an estate. And I remember the caretaker coming round for cups of tea on a regular basis. And although I definitely saw and experienced hardship that comes from a lack of finance, there was also lots of joy that came from being in community. But on the flip side of that, there was difficulty for me that has really played out in my adulthood. So I went from going to a nursery where I was one of many people of various colours, to going to a very exclusive private school in South Kensington, where the children that attended, their parents were ambassadors, politicians, actors, people that come from intergenerational wealth. And I was a little Black girl from the 13th floor of a tower block in Ladbroke Grove. So I knew that, and I was the only Black girl in the lower part of the school. There was one other Black girl who was in the upper part of the school. So I knew that I was very different from the other children. And although I was different, I was very keen to assimilate. And I know that because up until maybe 15 or so years ago, I don't know where the picture's gone, I had a drawing of my mum, and it was a white woman with yellow hair and red lips, even though I grew up with a dad who always enforced Black history lessons, and a mum, when we would go to Portobello Road Market, would tell me why we weren't allowed to buy fruit that had the cape sticker on it because of apartheid, and then things like that. And then due to financial difficulty, I was unable to remain in that school, and I went to a Church of England school in Shepherd Bush called St Stephen's. I don't know why I didn't stay there for very long, but I wasn't there for very long at all. And then I went to another Church of England school, St Clement's and St James's in Ladbroke Grove, where I was surrounded by people that looked like me that I couldn't relate to, and they couldn't relate to me because I had come from somewhere that I was having elocution lessons and learning which cutlery to use. So I didn't fit in at all. So I wasn't, although I had, I was friendly with people, I didn't really have friends. And that was my first experience of what I now know to be bullying, and that was colorism. I was really bullied by another girl who I really wanted to be my friend because of my dark complexion. And that haunted me for a very, very long time. And I
so
just...
Let me just, I'm going to pause, so don't forget.
Yep.
Just want to give this note. So colorism is where there is... it's a byproduct of the gorgeous white supremacy, but it is where we have hate within our own race. So where there is a belief that if your skin is lighter, RE, closer proximity to whiteness, then you are more superior. And so there is some race hate about the darkness of skin tone that goes on within the Black community and also within the Indian community. Indian caste.
Not just Indian.
Well.
When I went to Bali... I was amazed. So there were lots of Malaysian, Japanese and Chinese people on holiday. They were clearly you could see that they were using bleaching creams,
Yeah.
and they would be wearing massive, great big sun hats and draping shawls over their shoulders.
So they
And I knew
didn't
that that was code up for not getting
darker.
Darker.
Yeah,
And I
absolutely.
couldn't buy moisturizer when I was in Bali, not in the area I was in, because all of the moisturizers that I was seeing in the local shops contained bleach.
Yeah. When was this?
This was in 2018.
Yeah. Yeah, it's prolific. Yeah. We yeah. call it colorism in the Black community. I'm sure it's got other names in other mm-hmm. in other communities, but it's rife, and what is governing it is white supremacy.
Yeah.
So yeah, sorry, I just wanted to give that note.
No, thank you for illuminating, because sometimes I take for granted when I'm talking, especially when I get into the passion zone, I could be delving into territory that some people are not familiar with, so thank you for that. So I went to that school, and I never really fit in there. And then we moved from Ladbroke Grove to Greenford, borders of Southall. And I went to a few different schools there. I went to a school that my mum just didn't like the school, Dorm as well. So then I went to another school. And my experience there was really strange. And it was really strange, because my dad and his enforced Black history lessons was enforced, because I wasn't interested. I wanted to listen to Whitney Houston and Sunita and Bros and whoever else. And my dad was wanting me to listen to his recollection and books and videos. I remember 10 watching Roots, my dad making me watch Roots with context, no nothing, exactly, watching Roots. So my dad was very into sharing with me the narrative of Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
And he was very into the teachings of people like Kwame Nkrumah, who was the first president of Ghana after they became independent, of Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Sam Sharp. Like, my dad was very much on me knowing not just the Black African history of subjugation, but also the history of strength and resistance and innovation and pioneering, and the fact that the biggest power wielded by white supremacy was and is division amongst Black people, because united we stand, divided we fall. So when we moved to Southall, it was very strange for me to be amongst a Caribbean community that were very anti-African. I just could not understand it at all. And the anti-Africanness, that something that sticks in my mind really big time, I had gone to some under 18s rave, and I was sitting in a takeaway shop. I was sitting by the window, and a boy that lived on the estate that was kind of behind the house I lived in, he didn't think I could hear, but I heard him very clearly, put his head round the shop window, see me sitting there, and say to his friends, "That girl, she's African, you know." And they all peered round the shop window. Black boys, similar complexion to me, peered round the window to look at this African girl in awe. And I was like, this reminds me of the stories my mum told me about when she first came to England, living in Hillingdon, of all places, which was like Narnia at that time. And her people that later on became her friends, when she was first changing for PE, like, subtly but not subtly looking at her, and when my mum asked why they were looking at her, they wanted to see if she had a tail. So I had that experience however many years later from people that had been conditioned to view everything African as something they should distance themselves from, And seek to be more European
mm-hmm.
because that was superior,
mm-hmm.
which is another example of, or not another, but an example of internalized racism and race hate amongst
the black community. Yeah.
Which has been, it's like the seed was planted
yeah.
by white supremacy
yeah.
and they just nourished it with science, with religion,
yeah.
with legislation, with education, to make sure that seed grew
yeah.
so invisibly that there were many years, centuries, we walked around saying we don't know where that comes from. And I think it's only now really we are really powerfully
understanding
in a wider
yeah.
way, understanding and owning where that comes from and taking steps to heal
yes.
the interracial wounds
yes that we have inflicted apparent. That we have inflicted
yeah.
on one
yeah.
another. There's
yeah.
so there's, it's so layered, and I on the work that I do when I'm working with black women in particular, then we sort of interrogate and we explore all of this. And I, you just sharing about the sort of the anti-African, there was the African anti-African anti-Caribbean retort
yeah.
that went on between us. I remember having a conversation with you
mm-hmm.
Where there, you know, where we as in those of us from Caribbean heritage were the slaves, because we were taken from parts of Africa, and that the groups of Africans were the real Africans. And then, oh gosh, and the assimilation, you spoke about it, I hope it's okay for you to share.
Mm-hmm.
You started to notice, sort of in the height of multiculturalism in Britain, that some of your Asian peers were picking up on the nuances of that and sort of assigning you as being okay.
Yeah.
Because you were a certain type of black.
Yeah. Yeah. So very interestingly, like there are lots of people of various African backgrounds I know, my age group, because I do think it has changed over
yes.
the generations, that were brought up to fear people of a Caribbean background
wow.
because the story was that people of a Caribbean background were aggressive, they didn't study as much, and things of that nature. So, but because my parents were activists and because of their wide education, the narrative I grew up with is that we are all branches of the same tree, like we all belong to the same trunk.
Yes.
And that trunk is Mother Africa.
Yes.
So I grew up with that. But I also know, and I've shared this with you, Nova, that the version of assimilation or proximity to whiteness I grew up with and is very present from my knowledge amongst African countries that were former British colonies, education or educationalism. So the more Eurocentric and higher your education is, the closer your proximity is to whiteness.
Yes.
So so I'll joke and say, people talk about degrees and masters, West Africans eat PhDs for breakfast. Like PhDs, there are so many doctors, so many doctorates in my family. Like, it's a minor, like, please. Degree? What's a degree? We are talking PhD and all of that. Like, it's like, forget your degree. But it was that was our version of colorism. So what I grew up with was seeing lots of African people that had lots of qualifications. So I had lots of uncles that had PhDs that were cab drivers because
yeah.
of their colour and because of
yeah.
their accent.
Yeah.
But because Asian people that I experienced knew that African people generally were into education and would, what we now call tiger parent their children
yeah.
and sacrifice to ensure that their children had the best education they could possibly manage. I had experience of, and I didn't know what to do with it at the age of 10, 11, 12, 13, but I had Asian friends whose parents would make comments about it okay for me to be friends, and for me to be knocking at the door to walk to school with their children, because me being of an African background, my mum was well known in our area. She was the manager of a community centre. She created all sorts of initiatives for people to access employment and education. And because she was well known in the area and people knew that she was educated, where I grew up, well, the Asian people I grew up with, the children had permission to be friends with me because I was of an African background, a studious background. My parents, quote unquote, did well. So it was okay to be friends with me. Whereas other Black people, there was still race hate because there was very much a buying into this narrative that whiteness was at the top of the human hierarchy, and the darker you are, the lower you fell on the hierarchy. So growing up in Ealing Borough, there were lots of people of various different Asian backgrounds, and it was very interesting to see even how people of an Indian background that were fairer skin and of a higher caste treated people of a Pakistani background, regardless of their complexion, and how they treated people of a Bangladeshi background in a similar way that they treated Black people that they presumed to be of a Caribbean background, or as far as they were concerned, undereducated.
Oh yeah, it's so layered. Thank you for sharing that. And it takes me back to a memory I had, and I may have shared it with you, but I want to share it on this podcast, of I can't remember how old I was, but I was young, and my mum had gone out to top up. She'd gone out and she was topping up petrol somewhere, and she came back and she was really upset. She was angry. She was really rageful. And so listening to her story tell, she had an altercation at a petrol station where a man called her a black slave. Now, my mum is what we call in our community red skin. So she's very, very, she's a light skinned black woman, which also comes with its own passing privilege. The man who called her a black slave was a black man of African descent. And he was, they were going at each other in this petrol station. Nobody was intervening. It got quite physical, actually. He ended up trapping, my mum is feisty. She went over to tell him about himself after he called her a black slave. And she put her hand into his car because his window was down. And he wound his window up and trapped her arm in there. Yeah, all sorts of stuff going on. But the interesting thing was, you know, forecourt, other customers, forecourt staff, they just saw these two black people rowing at each other and just left them to it.
Let them at it, yeah.
But I was just perplexed for ages. I was like, how can another black man call another black woman a black person? I just didn't get it until I was much older, and then I understood more about the anti-African, the anti-Caribbean, and all of that race hate that went on between us, it was just I didn't get it until I was much
older. There's been
older.
A lot of investment. This is the thing that we need to overstand. There has been a lot of investment into that. There has been a lot of investment into the division. And the thing that is very, very interesting for me is how, because of the pervasive, it's like carbon monoxide. You don't know it's there unless you've got a really sophisticated alarm that picks up the carbon monoxide, or you're dead. So we are only just now, really in a powerful way, on a broad scale, because there are some people who have always been hearing that alarm
of
ringing.
Course.
But most of us, we were operating at such a low level trying to survive, we couldn't hear that alarm bell ringing. And for example, the ethnic group that my parents come from, my mum in particular, she recalls stories of her great grandmother talking about her grandmother, and due to the pronunciation, it was all narrative about West Indian. The ethnic group that my family comes from is an ethnic group that is made up of enslaved people that returned back to Africa. Freetown, there's a story about Freetown in Sierra Leone being set up by the Freetown Company or whatever it was called, because it was a way of allowing black people to return back to where they came from so that they could connect with their roots and whatnot. No, Freetown was set up because at the end of slavery, Britain didn't want loads of black people roaming around Britain, breeding with the indigenous people, creating brown babies that could possibly one day become black babies. And they didn't want to provide them with health, housing, and all the things that human beings need. So they created Freetown. Mm-hmm. So it is very likely, from what we can work out, because, you know, Africans are very oral, there's not much recording that happened. Very much storytelling. From what we can work out from stuff that was in archive and the stories that were handed down from my family, it's highly likely that we have family in Grenada. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, again, It's not that far away. My mum was told these stories by her great grandmother. In the middle of Sierra Leone, there is the cotton tree, which is like our Trafalgar Square, let's say. And that mighty cotton tree is where people that were enslaved, that were returned back to Africa, they would congregate under there. And a lot of them were enslaved people from Jamaica, so they built a maroon church so that they could worship and gather and have a sense of community in that maroon church. But that came with its own set of challenges. The indigenous people in Sierra Leone didn't agree with the chief that sold land, Freetown, to Britain to enable them to settle returned enslaved people. So that created its own set of drama there, because the story that was told to keep slavery going is that the black people in the Caribbean were unruly, they were animalistic, they were people that wouldn't have been beneficial to being in Africa. So that story was being bought into for a very, very long time, when the truth was the most highly skilled, strong, resourceful, and talented Africans were being taken into the Caribbean to fuel the industrial revolution that we all benefit from today. But we benefit from it at the expense of our ancestry, where many people benefit from it because of what we endured and what lives in our DNA to this day.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that insight. It's just, there's so much we don't know. There's so much more to understand about who we are and how multifaceted we are, and also how connected we are. That's the part that we've been seduced by the seduction of the undercurrent of white supremacy, that we've forgotten about all this stuff. We've forgotten about how connected we are. We've forgotten about the power of being in community, and we're fragmented. The work that I do, and I hope I'm able to do much more of, is this collective healing piece. There's healing that needs to happen with people who hold white privilege, white people and people who hold white privilege. There's healing that needs to happen within the black community, and then there's healing that needs to happen with every other minority ethnic group, and then that needs to all come together. And we start that by doing the inner work. We start that individually by doing our inner work. Can I ask you a question about what the impact may have been? So you said you said education and PhDs were kind of the colorism within your African community. And that sort of the byproduct of that, I believe, is over-functioning, having all of these qualifications, this expertise, this experience. What is the impact of that? What was the impact of that on you?
The impact was and is that there were impossible standards for me to reach. So the education system that we have in the Western world is not somewhere that I thrive. It's not somewhere, you know, for me. It is not somewhere that got the best out of me at all. So I really, like, my truth, Nova, and anybody that's listening, I coasted. I was the original coaster. And I was fortunate that my coasting was roundabout average with peaks of brilliance. So I got away with a hell of a lot by not doing very much. And it's not because I'm lazy, it's because I was totally uninspired by the education system, and there was a hell of a lot I didn't understand. So there was no way in the system as it was, there was no way for me to operate in my zone of genius. So for a very long time, and I still have dances with it now, for a very long time I believed that I was lazy. I wasn't lazy. The education system, you know, one size does not fit all. The education system did not bring out the best in me, but I literally beat myself up with feelings of not being good enough and feelings of being unworthy, because A, I didn't fit into that system, and B, this is the biggest one, I knew that I was operating way below my capacity, but I didn't know how to be able to stretch and maximize my capacity, because the only thing available was the traditional Eurocentric British based education system, which I, from the reading and study I've done, can see the education system we have was built around the Industrial Revolution to provide the Industrial Revolution, the Industrial Revolution with workers to keep fueling the coppers of the top 5, 10, 1%. So if you're somebody like me, who education needs to be very experiential, and that's why I have chosen the somatic coaching path, I need to feel it and experience it in my body. My brain is very, the part of my brain that I use, the part of the brain that we use, is very limited because of the way we're conditioned, and also because of how humans human. So I need to really feel things, experience. I need it to go to my head brain, my heart brain, my gut brain. Once it gets into my gut brain, I can then use my head brain as a channel for all of my wisdom. But the education system operates at the level of information gathering. And for somebody like me, that just doesn't turn me on.
No, and it didn't allow for it. And if we really start stripping back to our ancestry, like we... in terms of Pan-African spirituality, we used to have the cognitive and the spirituality, including, you know, being connected with nature. We've lost that. We've become disconnected. So we used to go and call upon our own inner wisdom, and we've somehow been we're not able to do that anymore, because we're in these systems that do not serve us, or they certainly don't serve us in the way that they were intended. So you sort of going back to that natural way of learning and integrating is really interesting to me, because that's in your ancestry.
And you know what's so beautiful about that, Nova? Number one, when I was at my most fragile, when I was like at a point in 2016, I was like, I got to a stage where I was at my full capacity. I was at the top of my survival capacity, feeling like I was going to implode, not explode. And what began my transformation was all those moments of feeling so lost and disconnected. I would be looking outside my bedroom window into the garden, looking at nature. nature gave me so much guidance, it was unreal, but I didn't realize what was happening at that time. So I was really pleased when you were talking earlier on about us forgetting, because it's not that we don't know, it's that we've forgotten.
Yes.
We may not know it cognitively, but our bodies know it.
Yes.
Because it is encoded in our DNA.
Ooh.
Even if you look at the science that shows that we were in our grandmother's wombs, our mothers, all the eggs our mothers would have that would then go on to create children if they chose to have children, or if they were in the position to have children, those eggs developed when they were in their mother's wombs.
Mm.
So we were receiving DNA coding from our grandmothers whilst we were in our mother's wombs, who were in their mother's wombs.
Wow.
So even if you think about it that on that level, there's lots of studies around epigenetics, and epigenetics
yes.
have shown how people from the Jewish community carry trauma
yes.
their ancestors experienced in the Holocaust. So if I think about my lineage, I don't just have the African lineage of people that were always in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
I also have the lineage of people that were rooted up and separated
yeah.
and taken into bondage. So
yeah.
I've got the experience of those that saw their brothers, their sisters,
yeah.
their mothers, their lovers being taken off into bondage. I
yeah.
also had the DNA coding of people that were in bondage.
Yeah.
So I have all of that within me. And I just didn't realize that I'm looking right now at my neighbor's tree in my garden. I didn't realize that looking at that tree on a cellular level was activating wisdom that's
mm.
always been there,
mm.
waiting for me to be in a space where I can access it. And my most profound, deep, nourishing learning, even if it was really uncomfortable and felt like being dragged through a hedge backwards at the time, has come from going within.
Yeah.
Not this very capitalistic
yes.
Way of being where we outsource
yes.
and we put our power to one side
yes.
so that we can outsource and buy in
yes.
wisdom. I
yes.
actually gained most power from going within. But that said, I did need to purchase an outsource in order for me to be able to get there.
Of course.
Because there were so many layers that needed to be peeled.
Of course.
I wouldn't be able to peel those on my own, and I wasn't able to see my blind spots. So our beautiful friend, Nicola Ray Wickham, was the first person I worked with in the coaching space who helped me to understand that these layers
mm-hmm.
I was carrying, some of them were not my own,
yes.
and some of the layers were shields that I developed to protect myself.
Yes.
So as soon as she said that, I was like,
oh
my goodness.
Yeah.
Not only do I remember this on a cellular level, I remember this on an academic and experiential level, because
mm.
that was my whole career as a social worker.
Of course.
But because I was so busy looking at it in people that were very socially, economically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually disadvantaged, I couldn't see it in myself
yes.
because I was sold, I bought into the story that I'm educated, I'm
yep.
healthy, I should get on with it, I should
yep.
be strong, pull myself together,
yep.
all of those sorts of narratives that only served to diminish and suppress the...
your life force.
Thank you. There
yeah.
we go.
Your life force.
Yeah, my life force energy was stifled by this notion that I should be and could be strong because I'm so lucky that X,
yeah.
Y, Z.
Yeah. It's that gift that keeps on giving. Thank you, white
mm-hmm.
supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
But what beautiful learning. And it's just that it's peeling back the layers. And
mm-hmm.
I'm just doing some reading on it. So I'm not fully, it's not fully formed, but there's so much about the essence of who we are in terms of what our ancestors used to do in terms of practicing Pan-African spirituality
mm-hmm.
and that community and that inner wisdom, trances, whatever it might be, that all of the stuff around spirituality that existed before colonizers came in
mm-hmm.
and accused us of,
devil worship,
devil
witchcraft.
Worship, you know, banning drumming and all the stuff that kept us in community and helped us stay well and, you know, and connected us to its spirituality, and then sort of enforce other belief systems that we know now. Like that existed before Christianity and before mm-hmm. all these other belief systems. That, mm-hmm. And yeah, so just stripping back and trusting in that inner wisdom is more powerful than I think people realize. So I encourage anyone listening, mm-hmm. this way you can show up and be yourself, and to start this chain I keep talking about of collective healing is to start mm-hmm. with your inner work. Start yes. on yourself.
Yes. Like, even, you know, it's the end of May. We are in a situation where just let's say in the last 10 days, let's just say, for argument's sake, in the last 10 weeks, I mean 2 weeks, in the last 2 weeks we've had the information about the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. Yeah. Maybe I've said his name wrong, but in America, we all know who that. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm very certain you know who I'm talking about, who was shot by two white men in America when he was jogging. We have had the news about this black man in America who George Floyd choked to death for suspicion of forgery. Meanwhile, Dylan Roof, who shot 9 people in a church in America as an act of white supremacy, white terrorism, was bought a Burger King on his way to the police station by the police.
Yep.
We have had that. So there's been Ahmaud, there's been George, there's been
Brianna,
there has been black people being more than 54% more that's been stopped and fined for COVID-19 offences. They've been stopped and fined 54.9% more than their white counterparts for doing the same thing. We've got black people disproportionately dying of COVID-19 related mm-hmm. illness. There has been something else. Oh, then I came across on Amazon, there's a book mm-hmm. that was called 10 Little N-Words being sold for £250 on Amazon Marketplace. Mm-hmm. It's not by, it's by somebody who's using Amazon like an eBay kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And there was also somebody that was selling something that looked like a gollywog doll being hung with blood trailing out of its mouth. Those are things that I have encountered in the last 10 to 14 days
yep.
alone. And what I know to be true, where I am right now is fully in that Toni Morrison quote about the very function of racism being distraction.
Yes.
I am calmly outraged about this. And I know that that seems like an oxymoron, but it is a very still, cold, steely outrage about this. And it is a cold, steely outrage because I know that whilst I take note of those things, whilst I see those things happening, whilst those things activate me on a cellular level, because yes. my cells recognize that, my cells have experienced all of that.
Yes.
What I know to be true is that it is really, really important for me to acknowledge that, tend to the discomfort, the grief, the yes. pain, all of that stuff that comes from that, not bypass it, tend to it,
yes.
maintaining my focus on my work. Mm-hmm. Because if I maintain my focus on my work, I extend and expand my capacity, and I am able to grow and rise and take up space in a much more powerful way, and I am able to provide support for people that look like me, and also hold a mirror to people that are curious about the part they play in the systems that allow these things to happen. Me allowing myself to become melded into that outrage serves no purpose to me and the greater assignment I have, because I will be so consumed and taken over by that rage,
yes,
that I will be living in that rage. I will be back into the survival scarcity zone, and I will not be able to take the long-term assignment I have been given to be able to be the biggest, grandest version of myself. And by, even if people don't work with me in any of the offerings I have, purely by taking up this, my space in this resplendent way, I give people that look like me and people that care about people that look like me,
yes,
because they genuinely care about humans, I give them permission to take up space, their space, in the biggest, grandest possible way they can.
Oh, God! Yes, Tamu. Literally, I'm sitting here, I'm halfway hanging off my chair. I've got goosebumps all over my body. This is it. This is the work. We tending to our grief and our pain and whatever else comes up in the moment is vital. Expressing healthy anger is vital, because when we don't express it, it turns inwards on our body and it becomes unhealthy. And that can look like many different things. That can look like illness, that can look like judgment, that can look like express long periods of rage, which do not serve us. They don't serve us. So that's why I keep talking about the power of healing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the way we resist this bullshit that's going on around us is to prioritize our healing and to find ways to live in joy. That is how we resist. So you're just giving.
Can I tell you something? Can I just add something to that, Nova?
Please.
The joy piece. So when I talk about being the purveyor of joy and all of that, it's not some schmaltzy, saccharine, sweet Hollywood. Yeah. the joy that I talk about is, I got this definition from a biblical website called Theopedia, and it says that joy is a state of mind and an orientation of the heart. It is a settled state of confidence, contentment, and hope.
Mm.
That allows you to be whole. And the more I've leaned into my joy, the more I've been able to lean into my pain. And leaning into that pain has enabled me to create more joy.
Yes. Yes.
And I am no longer using my joy as an act of resistance. My rest is not an act of resistance. It is mine. I have a right to it.
Yes.
If it ends up being an act of resistance, so be it. But my joy, my rest, my relaxation, my receiving, that is mine, all mine. It is not a fighting tool. It's not a secret fighting tool. And what I believe is, what all of my work about is, nourishing your foundation, nourishing your soil. When you nourish your foundation, when you nourish your soil, simply because you are a human being, out of the possibility of 40 odd billion things you could have been in this life as,
yes,
you were born a human being. My right as a human being is all of those things.
Yes.
That doesn't mean that I don't experience all the other more sticky, what we may perceive to be negative things. But when you really nurture your soil, when you start with that inner work, when you start with you, because you are entitled to it. And I use that word with intention.
Yes.
I use that word deliberately, because a lot of people feel triggered by the word entitlement.
Yes.
You are entitled to rest, joy, relaxation, expansiveness, abundance, all of those things. When you do that for yourself, the byproduct is your finances are enhanced, your work relationships are enhanced, your interpersonal relationships are enhanced, the way that you move in the world is enhanced.
Mm.
When you do your work,
yes,
you can then go and do the get rich from your business coaching and you will thrive from it. You can then go and do the career development courses. You can then go and do, I want to learn how to be a public speaker. When you start from the roots, when you start from yourself, That is when you are able to show up in all of the domains of your life resplendently. Do not take for granted the potency of doing your work.
Do not take it for granted, because it changes the world.
It changes your world, and then you go out and you change the world.
Exactly.
It is not frivolous. It is not indulgent. It is not you being spoiled. You taking the time and investing in whatever way you feel called to enhance your life so that you can tend to those feelings that you usually sidestep and dodge, so that you can actually explore the gifts within those feelings and alchemize that shit into your fertilizer.
Yes.
That is not frivolous. It is essential, fundamental, radical.
Oh, it's radical. And I just want to pick up on something you said about that definition of joy that you use, because I think it's just encapsulated it so beautifully. There's a bit that stuck with me: a settled state of confidence, contentment, and a hope. And I think the hope piece is really, really important, because even in the height of such trauma and such violence, our ancestors were able to cling on to that.
Yep. Yep.
That was how many of them survived the horrendous regime that they were living in. That hope,
and furthermore,
that joy, living regardless of.
Right. And furthermore, let us not dishonor our ancestors by continuing to live out their experience in modernity. Let us not dishonor our ancestors by taking for granted the lessons they have encoded within our DNA.
I
did a Black History project with my podcast, where I shared a podcast episode from various Black women talking about inspirational Black women and their legacy. And I said something along the lines of, our ancestors endured and whatever else, and stood strong for us to be able to stand upon their shoulders. Our ancestors do not want us to continue to survive. They endured all of what they did so that our parents could survive. Our parents survived what they did so that we can go up the next level. We cannot continue to be operating in the level of survival. We do ourselves a disservice. We do our lineage an injustice when we operate in that way, which is why it is so important for us to prioritize doing our work. Because when we do our work, that whole thing about being content, confidence, and hopeful, when you increase your capacity, when you enable yourself to be more resourceful, you can be in a state of calm outrage, because you still have a level of contentment, that you still have some level of agency in your inner world.
Yeah.
And you have some level of agency in the outer world. It might not be what it should be and what it could be, but you do have some level of agency, contentment. I am confident that if I continue on the path that I am on, that I will be able to make change that is past sharing a post of outrage on social media.
Yes.
And I am hopeful. I, even within this grief, even within me, like, what the actual MF is going on?
Yes.
I can still be hopeful that me showing up as I am wholeheartedly creates ripples of hope that will then be picked up by anybody who is in my energetic slipstream.
Yeah, love it. Love
I can't
it.
Be happy with this, all this. Oh, I just want to be happy.
That's bypassing the full range. That's bypassing the full extent of being human. That's not living truthfully. Living truthfully is knowing that all of these things can coexist, and we have to tend to the stuff that gets in the way of us.
I rock with Nova Reed.
Tamir and I are at church today. I want to say this. So, I held a life program for Black women at the end of April to beginning of this month, May. And one of the things I said that seemed to stick with all of them, just going back to what you said about our ancestors having to endure, I truly believe that one of the biggest ways we can honour our ancestors is allowing ourselves to heal.
Amen. 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 Because with healing comes forgiveness.
Yes.
How much of our own experience that isn't, that the cause isn't ours, the cause is white supremacy, yet we blame ourselves.
Yeah.
If I spoke more eloquently, if I didn't express my upset and it was received as me being an angry black woman, if perhaps I made myself smaller, if perhaps I dressed in a certain way, if perhaps my hair wasn't so big, if perhaps all of this stuff is ways that we blame ourselves. And some of the things that we carry, some of the things that we need to heal from, we need to forgive ourselves.
Yes.
We need to forgive ourselves for buying into this story that was peddled so hard and so strong for centuries.
Yes.
That we bought into it.
Yes.
I speak to black women. There's been a couple of black women that I've coached, and I've talked to them about forgiveness. I've invited them to forgive themselves.
Nice.
And it has amazed me that I've had to teach them what forgiveness is.
Yes.
Because what they were doing was giving themselves a pep talk. You can do this, you're better than this, come on, da 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 da. That's not forgiveness.
Mm.
That is bypassing the reality of your experience.
Mm-hmm.
That is you dismissing the depths of the hurt and the pain you are feeling.
Yes.
That is caused by your understanding of the way things are.
Mm.
But there was just this, I was just like, wow, we don't even know how to forgive ourselves. No, it's not even, we don't even know. We have forgotten how to forgive ourselves, and we fear forgiving ourselves because we are scared of the can of worms that will be opened when we start to acknowledge all the things we need to forgive ourselves for. And let me tell you something for free. Without forgiveness, you're not going to heal.
100%.
And I am saying that fully, wholeheartedly, not just with my whole chest, with my whole entire being. And I'll tell you, I'll say it again. Without forgiveness, you are not going to heal. Without forgiveness, you are not going to transform. Without forgiveness, you are not going to be able to operate at your highest, grandest, greatest capacity, because you are going to be carrying heavy, heavy baggage that will not allow you to be who you really need to be.
And my understanding of forgiveness, this is something that is for us. It's not for,
it's for
our
you.
Forgiveness of self. It's for us. It's not for other people that may or may not have wronged us. It's for us.
Mm-mm.
That's the reframe. Mm-mm. That I think is very important. Very,
very important. And it's important to acknowledge when you are able to really forgive yourself, you are highly likely to experience huge, massive feelings of grief and sorrow.
Yes.
Huge feelings of grief and sorrow for all the ways you have oppressed yourself.
Yes.
And all the experiences you have denied yourself. But let me tell you something really magical, potent. It doesn't matter, and I'm not saying this frivolously, so maybe let me think of a better way to say it rather than it doesn't matter. Do not get stuck in the bigness of those feelings, because those feelings are yours.
Mm.
Those feelings come from you. It doesn't matter how big those feelings and those sensations, your bodily sensations, become. You are the generator of those feelings. Therefore, you are always bigger than those feelings and those sensations. They do not define you. So what I would invite you to do, if you are exploring what you feel called to forgive, just remember to take a step back. It's not, I am sad, I am experiencing sadness. when you're able to slightly detach so that you can take a look with curiosity,
yes,
these big feelings and these big sensations that you're experiencing, you are not merging yourself with the feeling, you are being the custodian of the feeling. Then you have the opportunity to mother yourself. Then you have the opportunity to offer yourself a space of healing. Then you have the opportunity to reparent yourself.
Yeah,
it's very, very important.
Hugely important. I'm so glad we ended on that. Tamir, I could talk to you for hours. Oh, you've just given me so much more than I ever could have imagined. Thank you so much for sharing your heart and so much wisdom. Before I let you go, please can you share more about, you know, because I know you would have evoked a lot of feeling and inspired people to take action. So who are the people that you work with, and who are the kind of people that you work with, and where can they find you?
I work with women that are quite far into their healing journey and are starting to realize that there are blind spots they need support with. I work with women that are starting to be awakened to realizing that actually the best way they can heal themselves is by befriending themselves and turning inward into their own innate wisdom, which is why I chose, like, I've been quite a somatic practitioner, even as a social worker, but it was something that was very natural and innate. So I decided to do a accredited somatic coaching course because I wanted to understand the academics and the science behind it. And what I am learning is that somatic coaching, working in a somatic way, is a really beautiful invitation to become your own best friend. So rather than acting from, somebody has said something, it's triggered you, your throat has become dry, you feel like you've got a lump in your throat, and you react, the somatic approach is starting to learn what these bodily sensations have to tell you,
yes,
and being able to explore them so that you can respond,
yes,
from a place of resourceful creativity and wholeness.
Yes.
And it helps you to stop fearing these big feelings and understand that you are bigger than these big feelings, and that there is a lot of wisdom and nourishment below those big feelings.
Yes.
However, the caveat is, this is not for somebody who is at the beginning of their healing, mm-hmm, development, growth journey. If you want somebody that is going to give you how-tos and three-step processes, that's not what I do. My work is quite esoteric, and you really see it in action when something happens and you're like, oh my goodness, I do not feel called to respond to this how I used to respond to,
yes,
this. I've actually got a larger capacity to be able to work my way through and sort and sift, so I know what is my stuff and what is the stuff that is arising out of this situation,
yes,
I find myself in. So it's for women that are starting to accept that they are leaders and are curious about redefining leadership for themselves so that they can step into leadership as it presents itself to them.
Wonderful. And where can they find you, Tammy?
You can find me. The best place to find me, my playground, my friendship bench, is Instagram. And I am there as at Live360. And that is LiveThreeSixty. Or at my website, www.live360.com. I think the best place to experience me is by signing up to my newsletter and receiving some digital nourishment from me. Oh, and I just thought I'd add that my niche, the area that interests me the most, is women that are approaching their middle years.
Yes.
Because I just believe that when you start to knock on the door of 40 and you're 40 and beyond, you're like, do you know what? It's my time. I'm ready to take the next step.
Woo! Oh gosh. I can't let you go just yet. I can't let the Queen of Joy going without,
okay,
asking this one last question. Keep it keep it
concise.
Short for me.
Yes.
How do you find joy? What brings you joy?
You know what, Nova? I bring the joy. I bring the joy. So I'm not waiting for something outside to come and bring me the joy. I bring the joy. And that joy comes from being true to myself.
Mm.
It's taken a lot of work. It's taken a lot of practice. And it will be far too long for me to explain the ins and outs. But once you get to that place where you feel confident to be true to yourself, joy is everywhere. Joy is even in brickwork, let me tell you.
Tamu, I adore you. Thank you so much for saying yes and being on my podcast. I think what you do and what you bring to the world is incredible and needed now more than ever. So I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much, Nova. And I reflect that right back to you, not in that way whereby I'm not accepting the compliment, because I certainly am. But Nova, I just feel like you are a breath of fresh air that is breathing life into really difficult conversations and showing that with practice, difficult conversations become easier and easier to have. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. And there it is, a dose of joy and wisdom for you in the middle of these curious times. And I hope you got some nourishment out of it as much as I did. Listen to it again. I'm sure you'll learn more re-listening. A reminder, if you want to connect with Tamu and you want to join a community of joy seekers who are not bypassing their pain, who are dealing with all of the big feelings as well, she has a membership over on Facebook group, over on Facebook, which you can sign up to for a nominal fee per month, vital for managing well-being. I am also hanging out in there, so you might see me in there too. Secondly, thank you again to my patrons. I have started a Patreon to try and make these podcasts more sustainable. They are really, really difficult to manage without any support. So I'm hoping that with more supporters, I'll be able to start outsourcing editing, and so I can continue and this can be sustainable, because I know it's providing you with a rich resource. So if you value the work and you value this avenue, I'd appreciate your support there, and you can do that at a nominal fee. And yeah, the reminder, if you are being called to do this work and you're ready to take action now, my anti-racism course is ready and waiting for you. I will link to it, as I always do, in the show notes. Yeah, I will be back after a short break. Please take care of yourselves and each other. And I will just say, if you are white and or if you're not in the black community right now, just reach out to your black friends and check in on them and ask them how they're feeling and ask them if you can hold space for them. Sometimes just being held and heard and having our pain and trauma acknowledged can be a real gift. So yeah, that's something you can do to ally alongside us. Thank you for sharing this corner of the internet with me. I will see you after I have replenished. Take care of you.